America's relationship with guns has undergone a profound transformation since its founding. When Charlton Heston raised a rifle above his head at the 2000 NRA convention and declared they'd have to take it from my cold, dead hands, he embodied a deeply personal, individualistic understanding of gun rights that would have bewildered the founding fathers. The Second Amendment wasn't originally about personal self-defense or hunting. It established a civic right tied to militia service, requiring citizens to arm themselves for community defense. This civic understanding has been lost in our polarized debate. The amendment's original meaning was neither the unlimited individual right championed by gun advocates, nor the collective right of states preferred by gun control supporters. Instead, it represented a Minuteman ideal, a civic obligation requiring citizens to maintain weapons at personal expense and defend their communities when called upon. This conception was more communal than modern gun rights rhetoric suggests, and more martial than gun control advocates acknowledge. When British troops arrived in Boston in 1768, colonial resistance drew on established English legal principles. For colonists, militias represented virtue and liberty in contrast to standing armies' tyranny. British bans on military supplies and weapons were viewed as unconstitutional violations of their rights as English subjects. The militia wasn't merely military, but central to colonial life, preserving order, providing protection, and serving as a social organizing force. Colonists defended their right to bear arms by citing both the English Declaration of Rights of 1689 and their own militia laws. Samuel Adams referenced Blackstone, who classified bearing arms as the fifth auxiliary right of British subjects, a political safeguard against tyranny, not a personal right. Well-regulated appears in the Second Amendment because colonists embraced well-regulated liberty as fundamental to a functioning republic. States enacted comprehensive militia laws requiring citizens to purchase specific military-quality weapons and ammunition. These laws mandated regular maintenance with mandatory inspections multiple times yearly. Militia captains conducted home visits to verify compliance, imposing fines for improperly maintained weapons. Shays' Rebellion in 1786 alarmed national leaders like Washington, who feared combustibles in every state, which a spark might set fire to. This crisis accelerated efforts to reform the Articles of Confederation, with military reform becoming central to constitutional convention discussions. In Philadelphia, many delegates, especially former Continental Army officers, had lost faith in militia effectiveness. These nationalists wanted a standing army and either federalized militia or an elite select militia. A minority, however, feared tyranny more than disorder, concerned that removing state control of militias while strengthening federal power would eliminate crucial checks against corruption. The resulting compromise granted federal authority to organize, arm, and discipline the militia, while states kept officer appointment and training control. When George Mason proposed adding a Bill of Rights, the convention declined, a mistake that became a major ratification objection. Anti-Federalists insisted state militia control was vital to prevent federal overreach, while Federalists dismissed these concerns, with Noah Webster noting that the whole body of the people are armed, making tyranny impossible. Despite Federalist victory, anti-Federalist concerns required accommodation. James Madison synthesized amendment proposals from state conventions, initially writing, "The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, a well-armed and well-regulated militia being the best security of a free country." The House revision crucially placed the militia clause first as a preamble establishing the amendment's purpose. Senate debate focused on federalism and militia control, resulting in the final text, "A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." When addressing militia reform, Washington and Secretary Knox proposed nationalizing the militia, but fierce opposition defeated this plan. The Uniform Militia Act of 1792 defined the militia as free, able-bodied, white male citizens between 18 and 45, with arming responsibilities falling to individuals and states. Cities implemented additional public safety regulations. Boston's 1786 law prohibited storing loaded firearms in homes following accidental injuries. Similar ordinances in Philadelphia, New York, and other cities demonstrated that public safety concerns routinely trumped absolute gun rights. Common law also restricted armed travel through the crime of affray, going armed in terror of the people, creating a presumption against public carry unless justified. Post-war of 1812, America grew more democratic, aggressive, and individualistic. This individualism manifested in Americans carrying concealed weapons. Frederick Law Olmsted noted that in Kentucky, a Bowie knife was a universal and a pistol a not at all unusual companion. Many saw this armed individualism as corrupting American ideals. Between 1813 and 1859, states enacted America's first gun control laws in response to rising violence. Kentucky passed the first concealed weapons law in 1813, with Indiana following in 1820. These laws sparked legal challenges as civic and individual theories of arms bearing collided in court. In Bliss v. Commonwealth, 1822, Kentucky's Supreme Court interpreted bearing arms as an individual right not subject to regulation, a position outside mainstream jurisprudence. Revolutionary-era state constitutions generally emphasized militia service over individual rights. Pennsylvania protected the right to bear arms for the defense of themselves and the state, while Massachusetts became first to protect both keep and bear arms linked to common defense. The Supreme Court first addressed the Second Amendment in U.S. v. Cruikshank, 1875, arising from the brutal Colfax Massacre, where over 100 black citizens were murdered by white supremacists. The court rejected both individual and civic interpretations, instead endorsing a narrow states' rights view, declaring the amendment has no other effect than to restrict the powers of the national government. In United States v. Miller, 1939, the court unanimously ruled that the amendment had relation to the military service, establishing a crucial test, whether a weapon had a reasonable relationship to the preservation of a well-regulated militia, a standard that influenced firearms legislation for decades. What's been lost is the civic view of arms bearing that reads the amendment holistically. This original interpretation emphasizes that the right to bear arms is both an obligation to government and a protection against government interference, and crucially, that there can be no right to bear arms without extensive regulation. The Second Amendment belongs to all Americans, not just gun rights advocates. Neither a gun-free America nor accepting high levels of gun violence as freedom's price is realistic. Finding common ground requires recognizing that our constitutional tradition has always balanced individual liberty with public safety. Perhaps the most profound insight from studying the amendment's history is that the founders didn't see regulation as liberty's enemy, but its essential partner. Well-regulated liberty wasn't a contradiction, but a recognition that true freedom requires structure and responsibility. By reclaiming this nuanced understanding, we might move beyond our toxic gun debate towards solutions that honor both our rights and our responsibilities as citizens of a constitutional republic.